Ladies and gentlemen, the session will start in about 2 minutes, so please take your seats.
It's fine, actually. Okay. You can sit here if you like.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are going to start, so please take your seats. Welcome in the afternoon session. My name is Dr. Eberhard Lisse, and I will be chairing this part. Now, I'm Andrei Filip from Czech Republic, and because Nigel has some other meeting, he asked me to chair the second part of the day. In the second part, we'll have two regular presentations. One will be related to DNSSEC and second one to ENAM technology. And then there will be a venue change, and there will be a DNSSEC for beginners. The room will be upstairs. I will announce it later, so stay up to the end of the session. So the first presentation will be delivered by... by Roy Ahrens, and it will be about how did you say it?
About the DNSSEC incident.
About DNSSEC incident. So, Roy, floor's yours.
I hope that's actually readable. I have black slides with white characters on it. So, my name is Roy Ahrens. I'm the head of research at Nominet. We recently had an incident with DNSSEC, and this is my briefing of what happened exactly there. So, on September the 10th, in the early evening, one of our engineers on call got a SMS message, a text message from our monitoring system, and it says, "I can't reach the main signing system, go and check." Now, when you get something like that, you're very, very scared, because the main signing system is like, well, yeah, the main signing system. It is it is the spider in the web in our infrastructure to deliver DNSSEC. So when the engineer got on site, he noticed that the system had a kernel panic. And this kernel panic was actually related to a hardware security module that we use. I apologize for my voice. I lost it somewhere over the ocean. So, a kernel panic was related to the HSM driver. We use an SCA 6000 from Sun, now Oracle, that we use on a CentOS box. The problem was that we were unable to reproduce the kernel panic. And that's kind of annoying, because how can you test if you fix the problem if you can't reproduce the problem? Now, in regular cases, hardware failures happen. That's why you over-provision, right? Disks fill, CPUs burn out, network cables get detached somehow. And so that's why we over-provision. So it was critical, but we really didn't have any time pressure, because it wasn't a time-critical system. When we sign the UK zone, we have a two-week signature expiry interval. That means that when a system crashes now, we basically have 2 weeks to repair it, 2 weeks to restart signing again. We could have chosen 4 weeks, we could have chosen 1 week, we chose 2 weeks when we designed this. And so to recover from that, we had two simple failover scenarios. And by the way, this presentation is not about a failing piece of hardware. We had two simple failover scenarios. One is simply go the Microsoft way and restart the current signing system, right? Just press a button and walk away. And if that doesn't work, we could always use the secondary signing system. We have an active system somewhere else in some other data center. And that actually doesn't know that it's a secondary. It thinks it's the main. It just does exactly the same as the main one. I will get into that later. So, scenario number one, restart the system. That's actually simpler than it looks. Harder than it looks. We have proper security hygiene. What that means is we need a security officer on site to enable the HSM before it's used in production. The reason for that is someone might actually take that HSM away. And so we need credentials to enable that HSM if someone has stolen that HSM. So that means we require a presence of a security officer. Now, a security officer is not a guy with a badge; it's a set of people in our senior management team. The reason we have that is to have proper escalation procedures. So that you can't just mess with the system without a senior management team knowing. Then again, it was a Friday evening, and there was no time pressure. So we also had an alternative scenario, which is scenario number two, and we looked at that. Now, scenario number two, as I said before, is the active secondary system. It runs independent of the main signing system. And of course, before we actually switch over to that secondary system, we did some pre-deployment checks. These are not some. There's a whole list of things. I won't go into every little detail now. But we do that very thoroughly. And everything was ready to go, but it was still Friday evening. And still no time pressure. We had 2 weeks, right? So it was getting very late on that Friday, so we waited until Saturday. Now, on Saturday, we decided to make the secondary system active, right? There wasn't really any need to get a senior management team and an auditor and a system administrator on a Saturday morning inside Nominet headquarters. So we just basically, with a flip of the switch, could make the secondary system active. This also allows signing to continue. That means on the main signing system, where we had the failure, we could just look at the system, see how it failed, see why it failed, right? See if we can build fixes for it. I already mentioned this. And there was no need for a security officer on site. We could literally make the switch live remotely. And we started signing with the new system at 2:30. And everything looked correct, but something was not quite right. Basically, we saw that the systems worked perfectly, and we all went home. And then we did some checking, and then we noticed something was odd. And there was basically what I call an unfortunate state. the main and the secondary system did not use the same ZSK. Now ZSK, that's the zone signing key. I won't go into that details. There's a session on there's a session after this about DNSSEC for beginners that will probably mention something like a ZSK. But it's basically a key that you use for signing. It's not the main key, but it's a key that you use for signing. And the main and the secondary could not agree on what that key was, which is odd because you have to go basically from first look. You have to go out of your way to make these systems different. The secondary system is a carbon copy of the main signing system, so there should not be any difference. Of course, if you use two different keys, it led to some validation problems in the field, and those could actually be resolved by flushing the validator's cache or basically wait until the old key expires from the cache. But this was unexpected, and it should not happen. So we did some checking, we did some analysis, and we noticed that the secondary system had a older ZSK. What I mean with older ZSK, in DNSSEC there's something called DNS key rollover. You do that at some point in time. We did that at some point in time, but the secondary system wasn't up to par. The secondary system still had the old ZSK. But that wasn't actually possible in my mind, because we have so many checks in place, and like my good friend Kay Stoot said the other night, you can have 100,000 checks in place, you can do 1,000,000 tests, and they can all work perfectly. It just takes one bug to take the entire system down. Anyway, the older ZSK was signed properly by the KSK, right, and it validated fine. And the key set had a 48-hour TTL. Now, that means that when it validates fine, that means that the zone is internally and externally consistent. If you didn't cache anything, and you would start validating the UK zone from scratch, you wouldn't see any difference. Everything worked, right? And of course, one of the test scripts that we had built is basically test the internal consistency of the zone. And then it works. But here's the thing. Validators that had cached the old key would now see signatures by this newly introduced key. And of course, you can't validate new signatures with an old key. So, of course, this should still not happen. So we investigate a little bit further, and we take a look at our software. We use OpenDNSSEC to sign the UK zone, and basically, it consists of two main parts. There are other parts of OpenDNSSEC, but the main parts are basically the enforcer. The enforcer is a simple tool. It takes a policy, a set of configuration elements basically, and it turns it into a configuration file for a signer. So signer is, of course, the second part. The signer uses that configuration file to then sign the UK zone. And we noticed that the enforcer was unable to override that configuration. That means that the signer would still use the old configuration, which contains the old ZSK. Now, why has this not been flagged? This should have been flagged. Well, we use the auditor to check the zone status, right? Sorry? Okay, we use the auditor to check the zone status. And that auditor still does the internal internally consistent checking and the externally consistent checking, but still doesn't keep a cache. Then, if you look at the key set itself, we use a tool called ODS HSM Util. It's part of OpenDNSSEC. And the only thing that that does, it will list the keys in the repository. And of course, both systems tell you exactly the same thing. All the keys are there. And then we use ODS KSM Util to report on policy. And both systems, of course, had the same policy file. And what this utility does is very straightforward. It takes a policy file, it checks the current time, and it will tell you which keys should be active. And of course, it tells you then which keys should be active. And all these checks, we did that, and it's all consistent. We, of course, never checked if a file could or could not be overwritten. So we did some additional measures to circumvent these or to avoid these issues in the future. We updated our audit script to include caching. So basically, we start a little resolver called Unbound. And we see that with all the with all the current keys before we do a rollover. We monitor the file system to signal write failures. Also, an interesting thing, as you noticed, we used a TTL of 48 hours. 48 hours is extremely long. That's 2 days for those who can't count. But there's a reason that we had 48 hours. We just had a 48-hour TTL on the entire zone. And the UK zone, if you remember, we have a two-tiered zone. We have a UK zone, and under it, we have second-level domains like co and me.org. Org.uk, and so the UK zone is extremely stable. It's unlikely to change anytime soon. So a 48-hour TTL is basically fine because it's not going to change anyway. But of course, it also meant we had 48-hour TTL on the DNS key. So we brought the TTL of the DNS key down to 1 hour, and we thought we would get a 48-time increase on the load for the DNS key. We didn't. We actually got a doubling of the DNS key load instead of a 48 times over. I'm not sure if I actually should say this, but the doubling of actually hardly any load is still hardly any load. No one really is validating our zone. So another change that we made in our policies is that we don't require a security officer anymore to restart the main signing system. The main signing system sits in our data center. This data center is fairly secure. I think it's very secure. We have literally people with badges sitting downstairs. We have three-way security checks into that machine room. And if you are already in that machine room, I can tell you, the HSM is the least interesting thing that you want to get. Anyway, some lessons learned. You can't test everything beforehand. This is typically a case where when the moon is full and the dogs start to bark, right, and your children start to complain, right, and the food is unedible, right, and your wife is sick and your girlfriend, never mind. this is one of these cases where everything comes together in one moment. We also learned another thing, that hardly anyone is validating DNSSEC yet. When I said doubling the load, that was a load of 0.25 query a second. That means one query every 4 seconds for those who can count. And when we doubled that, it basically means one query every 2 seconds. So we are thinking we can even go further with churning that TTL down instead of 1 hour, maybe to 15 minutes or to 3 minutes. And, I mean, why not? I mean, the whole problems with DNSSEC queue all over, the reason why it's so expensive procedure to do is that you have to take care of caching. So how about taking care of this caching by not caching it for that long? So we are going to experiment in the future, in the near future, with churning the TTL down to an acceptable minimum. And since no one's validating anywhere, then, I mean, we don't really put any loads on any validators. What we also notice that when you have DNSSEC problems and folks can't validate, even though hardly anyone is validating, those that do are very vocal, and they will tell that on mailing lists. So problems get very quickly, very public. Another thing that we've learned, if you have a system crash, it's actually good to have it on a weekend, because it then takes 2 days to expire, and then it's Monday. One thing I want to clarify here, that this was actually unrelated to OpenDNSSEC. We think we can't actually investigate further because we had to reuse that system, we had to redeploy it. But when we noticed it couldn't override, we think it has to do with the permissions setting on a file. That signature, configuration file for the signer. This is typically, I don't know if that's actually happened, but typically what you get is when someone checks the file system, right? It opens the file in VI, right? Then accidentally change something. He wants to quit VI, and he can't do that because the system tells him, "Hey, you changed the file. You want to save it," and then saves it. And if he has done that as root, permissions has changed, and you're unable to override that file. That's what we think happened. We can't actually confirm that. So that's it for me. We've learned something very interesting. I hope you've done the same. If you have any questions, then I'd like to hear them. And I apologize for everyone who validated and who got stuck with invalidatable zones. Nigel, go ahead. Oh, sorry, yes, of course.
Thank you. I mean this question in kind of a technical way, like customer support. Did anybody outside the organization actually notice?
Oh, yes. Yes. We of course notice it ourselves, that's first, but outside of the organization, we saw a mentioning on Twitter from a guy working at Surfnet that he basically restarted his validator, or restarted his cache because he saw some validation issues. And that then percolates quickly to mailing lists, to retweets. This guy was the first. But to be fair, we only saw about four or five Twitter messages about it, something like that. And we were basically the ones who initiated the talk about this. We immediately sent on Twitter and on our main webpage that we had an issue, that we're trying to recover it, and that we update as soon as we have more information. And then we updated as soon as we had more information. So basically that caused more discussion than the actual incident itself.
Any other questions? Yeah. Warren?
So first off, thank you for being so transparent and actually explaining what happened. That's so much better.
Before you speak, please tell your name and...
Oh, sure. Sorry. Warren Kamari. Happened to be Google. During the actual event, did you notice any strange additional load or anything as people continuously retried, or not really?
I gave a presentation in Nairobi, and that was called Roll Over and Die, and we saw the exact same effect. But still, like I said, it was a very small load, and I don't have it on me here, but I can attach it to the slide. There's this one peak that is the exact same peak when you get in a situation where you have rollover and die. So we did see some additional load, but we get about 1.5 billion, something like 1.5 billion queries a month or something, or I forgot the number. So this completely noises out this little signal. So we didn't actually see additional load in terms of volume. Yes, if 5 years from now means that everyone is validating, yes.
Any other questions? If not, then thank you very much, Roy. Thank you very much indeed. And next presentation will be done by Pavel Tuma. And we change a little bit subject. We will not talk about DNSSEC, but Paul has a presentation about Enum and with title Enum for Masses, if I'm not mistaken. Before he configures computer, I will a little bit introduce him. He's a chairman of Enum Federation, so he's probably the best person who can speak about the situation from Enum, and he's also working in Czech registry, the CZNE.
Okay. Thanks for the introduction. Good afternoon. Before we'll answer the question whether Enum is there for the masses or not, let's do the quick overview of what Enum is, and then see What things are there in two main types of Enum, user Enum and infrastructure Enum, what's happening? So what Enum is, have you ever used voice over IP telephony calling over the internet? I think this is the useless question over here. Everybody has. The question is why. There are a lot of benefits the voice over IP telephony has. It's free. It's easy to use. You are mobile. You can use it wherever you are. But there's one question. How to call over the internet to somebody you don't know? You just received this business card from just somebody out there in the lobby. Are there any Skype contacts? Are there any other services, voice over IP services contacts? No, they are not. You can see there just the phone numbers. So this is the question of regular Enum or regular voice over IP service and the main problem. You have the origin. You are going to call somebody. You dial the number, and it gets over the internet because it's voice over IP service. It gets routed to your carrier switch box, and then because you dialed the phone number, which doesn't mean anything on the internet, it's routed to PSTN, and it goes through PSTN to the carrier B, to the carrier of the destination party. And then the call is delivered by PSTN if it's leased line, or by some kind of cell network if it's a cell phone. Or it's delivered over the internet if the destination party you dialed is on voice over IP the same way as you. And now it's clear where's the problem. You are using voice over IP. The person you are calling is using voice over IP, but there is still the red segment of the routing done over PSTN. So that's the question. How to keep the call for the whole time on the internet? And that's the purpose of Enum. Enum relates the phone numbers with an internet service. In this case, so voice over IP, the internet service is a SIP service. So you can see the phone number and the relation to the SIP account. Enum isn't just about voice over IP. You can relate to your phone number anything, almost any kind of internet services, but so far there is no use case for that. So what I usually say, Enum are the yellow pages of voice over IP enabled users. And why are we discussing it over here? Because it uses DNS, and they are what is called Enum domains. Enum domains are created from the phone number. Take the phone number in international format. Second step is to take out any non number characters. Then reverse the order of the numbers. Then put the dots in between. Now you can see it started to look like a domain, and in the last step at e164.arpa, which is the root of the Enum tree. Now you have pretty regular domain name, the same as any other domain name. You can send a query to the DNS, and you can get a reply. With Enum, the reply is not the IP address, but it's the SIP address. And then it's obvious if you do it, you can route over SIP instead of phone number. So you can route over the internet instead of PSTN. How it looks like in DNS? There is the new RR item, which is called NAPTR. It looks like this. But as you can see, only a small part of it is actually used. These are the boxes at the bottom. There is a preference which can say which records are preferred the same way as with delivering the emails, the MX records. Then it's the Enum service. I listed a few other services, then voice over IP, then SIP. But as I mentioned, it's not used. And the last one, the last part, is actually the content of the reply itself, meaning SIP address. You can use regular expressions to rewrite it to many, many options. So this is what Enum is, and there are two main Enum types. The difference is in the meaning of the SIP address in Enum DNS. From the end user's point of view, we need to know exactly what I've described. Can I reach the destination party over the internet and route my call over the internet the whole time for free? So this is the question for Enum for users, also known as user Enum. And the other main type is the infrastructure Enum, Enum for carriers, because the carriers do not need to know whether the destination party can be called over the internet. They usually need to know to which network the number belongs to and how to route the call to that network, regardless of whether it's over the internet or whether it's over PSTN. Let's take user Enum first. How the routing looks like with user Enum, just very briefly, you dial the number, the call is routed to your company PBX. The PBX does at this moment the query to the DNS. Basically it asks, is there Enum domain? Can I call the destination party over the internet? It asks the local DNS, and because usually it won't know the answer, the global Enum DNS will be asked. And then there are three types of results, three options. There's no Enum domain, and it's a PSTN number, so it's the call is routed to PSTN. There is no Enum domain, and the number is in a cell network, so the call is routed over the GSM or UMTS gateway to the cell network. And the phones on the right rings, and if the destination party takes the call, you started to pay. And the third most interesting option is there is a Enum domain, there is a SIP address in the NAPTR record, and you can route the call over the SIP gateway to the internet to the same devices, and the devices ring, and if the destination party takes the call, the call is for you for free because it's routed over the internet. So are there any deployment differences to deploy Enum from the registry point of view in DNS? There are none. It's just another RR item type, nothing else. Are there any differences in the registry systems? Yes, they are. You must know who is the registrant of the Enum domain. You must exactly know whether the person who tries to register Enum domain is the person who is using that phone number. Because otherwise there is a risk that somebody else will change the routing for the calls for my phone, for example. And you must this is called validation, and you must revalidate regularly. And that's the reason of the second difference. You probably will need to increase the registration period granularity in your registry systems because, for example, with .cz and Czech Enum, we have the lowest period for .cz 1 year for the registration, but with the Enum domains, we had to make 6 months as well because it's an non-written rule among the Czech carriers that if somebody returns the phone number, just cancel the contract and returns the phone number, there is a 6 months quarantine, and after 6 months they can give the same number to somebody else. So we must again ensure that the Enum domain and the routing within the Enum DNS is valid for the user who actually has the phone in the hand. The other difference is you will have to have the level overlays because usually the companies or the big organizations do not have only a single number, but have the blocks. And of course, you don't want them to, if they have 10,000 numbers, to register 10,000 domains, but just a single one. Or this is the example with just 1,000. And the last difference is the less informative Whois, where the registrant of the domain is not disclosed at all, because you must ensure that if you send the queries for the phone numbers, you couldn't actually get who is the user of that number. The differences are not big, but still there are some. The thread, the registry systems we develop and we provide, has all of them out of the box. I'm not sure about the other registry systems, but definitely because some countries already deployed Enum, I think there will be other options as well. That takes me to the what's happening worldwide. The user Enum, the public Enum, is in a sort of the deadlock. Some countries operate their country prefixes in Enum, but we definitely cannot call it success. What are the reasons? For the big carriers, the Enum is a sort of the killing the cash cow, because if the calls will be routed over the internet for free, where are the revenues from the minutes? There are no anymore. So big carriers are not interested in Enum at all. The small carriers are, of course, more interested in Enum than big carriers, but if you start to discuss it with them, you end up probably on the interconnection fees, because still the interconnection fees, if somebody, because they have a really small market share, it basically means that all incoming calls are from the other networks, and if they will start deliver calls over the Enum on the internet for free, they are scared that the others will start to deliver the phone calls to their network in the same way. And because the majority of incoming calls are from the other networks, they get the interconnection fees. And that's the problem. If they do not have interconnection fees, that lowers their revenue by a huge margin. And of course, the Enum is complicated for the end user. Compare it to Skype, compare it to FaceTime, Google Voice, Viber. There are a million applications, you name it, in the App Store or in the market on Android, which are just about downloading, registering, and that's it, and you can call. Imagine what it's required with Enum. You have to register the domain, you must validate somehow. Each 6 months you must revalidate. It's definitely more complicated. So, as I said, it's in a sort of the deadlock. All the countries in Europe experience the number of Enum domains decreasing and decreasing interest in Enum. But still, we are trying to find what will be the killer application for it, because it's still the phone number is still here. It's still the identifier of almost everybody with the cell phones. So maybe there is an application which can use the phone numbers. And there is an Enum Federation which we united together to promote Enum, to increase the awareness of the end users that there is a such thing as Enum. What we are trying to do is to create a brand. Imagine that it will be the similar as Bluetooth brand. If you buy two products with a small blue B logo on it, you are sure that these two products can communicate between them over Bluetooth, and that's our vision, what we are trying to set up with Enum too. The other type of enum is infrastructure enum, enum for carriers. Let's see how the routing over the infrastructure enum works. Let's have two networks, two carriers. The call originates in one of them and is delivered to the other. The user dials the number. It's delivered inside a network to some switch box. And over here is the similar process with the user enum. Now this switch box has to query the number in enum. Here it's the domain just with the numbers because this enum tree can be operated by actually anybody. There's no need to have public route and public tree for infrastructure enum. But it's still DNS, so the local DNS is asked. Then some probably more global or the federation DNS. And the reply which gets back is the SIP address. Now the interesting part is what is after the at character, which is carrier.cz. That's the identifier of the network. So now we know to which network this number belongs to. And if you send more DNS queries, first you query for SRV record for the carrier.cz. You get the host name of the SIP server, the infrastructure point where you should route that call. And if you send up another DNS query for A record, you get the IP address. And now, at this moment, you know to which network the number belongs to and how to route the call to that network. So the call is routed over the IP instead of PSTN and SS7 networks to the destination network, and of course it's delivered within the destination network to the device. What's the status? Infrastructure enum in the world never took off anywhere. Why? Because the carriers do not need the registries. They don't need us. They can build the infrastructure enum or enum tree or private enum tree as they wish. There is no need to have it closed in the root of the DNS. But still, there's the opportunity for us for the registries, and that's because the infrastructure enum is a really smart solution to the number portability database. It's required a number portability. It's in the country required by the regulator. This is really smart and elegant solution of the number portability database. But it still has some problems, and that's why it never took off. The reasons? The big carriers have really ancient equipment. From the discussion I had with all the major carriers in Czech Republic, sending the DNS query from their equipment is something from the dream world. The small carriers, which have more latest equipment, they have different problem. It is low priority to peer with other carriers over infrastructure enum, because they definitely won't peer with the big carriers because of the reason I just mentioned. And with other small carriers, there are 10 of them, 20 of them, 30. They can do the peering pretty much manually without any problems. So with them, it's really a low priority project. And that's basically it. That's the quick intro to enum and the status of enum out there. Are there any questions?
So it was a really good presentation and explanation about enum, but it was in the end a quite sad presentation, like we are giving up. And
well, it doesn't mean we are giving up. Still, all the member countries of Enum Federation decided to go forward with building of Enum brand. Actually, what I discussed with my colleagues this morning are the services like FaceTime with Apple. It means if you are on Wi-Fi and the destination party you are going to call is on Wi-Fi too, you can press in the contact list on iPhone just a different button to initiate a call, and it's a sort of the voice over IP telephony. But it's still just one service. The Viber service I mentioned is another service which does the same thing. And what we are trying to think about is whether the Enum could be the solution, the public Enum could be the solution to connect these islands together. Because with any of that of those services, FaceTime or Viber, you are required to call just to the users of the same service, the same with Skype. Basically, this is what are we going to explore, whether there is the option or the opportunity for that.
Hi, Pavel.
Other question?
Yes. Eric Brunner-Williams from ALAC, this meeting, my first. It looks to me like there's policy area. There's policy that's possible here. For instance, the connecting of what we now have as walled gardens, such as Skype. That is the public infrastructure Enum as well as the public user Enum, and that this policy area is outside of the normal scope of the GNSO. Is that your feeling as well? And because this is all sits under 161.ARPA, you know, E161.ARPA, this isn't, I don't know, there's policy development possibilities here that aren't in the GNSO playpen. Thank you.
It depends whether we believe if there is a need for public infrastructure Enum, and I would doubt that, because what I understood from the queries in Czech Republic, they are quite opposed to any solutions on peering or in the number portability sphere that is proposed by the regulator. That they are against the regulation, and they want the freedom to choose their own solutions, so they build their own number portability database instead of using Enum, for example. But still, yes, if there is something in the policy area, it might help Enum in both in infrastructure and public too.
Yeah. Patricio Boblete from Nick Chile. I wonder if you could elaborate a bit more on the opportunities of using Enum for number portability, and if there are any examples of cases where it has been used. Our interest is very real, because actually today the President of Chile signed into law the bill that to begin number portability in Chile, so there will be, in the very short term, people will have to think about it.
Actually, I don't know about any case where the number portability is done by infrastructure Enum. Mainly, that's the reason is really in Czech Republic the ancient equipment. Imagine what is the solution the carriers have now. They have the database which is distributed on the CDs once in a month, and they load the content of the database via some scripts manually into the infrastructure, and the process of porting the number to different network takes 3 weeks from the end user perspective. And all of the operators said, yes, we would use the number portability database in infrastructure Enum. There's it's really the best solution, but we can't, because it would be too big investment to upgrade all of our infrastructure.
Pavel, I think the UK number portability database was built on infrastructure Enum.
Okay, so Now we have the example.
Yeah.
I saw some other hands on the left-hand side of the room. Or are there any other questions? I don't see any. So thank you very much, Pavel. Thank you very much indeed for the presentation. That's almost all from this session, but before we finish, let me do some invitation to another session, which was also done by people that prepared this session, and it's going to be at 4 o'clock in a room called Commission 2 A and B, and it is an independent session, and let me a little bit read the agenda. It has 6 points. It's called DNSSEC for Beginners, and the first point is the history of DNSSEC by Simon McCullough, overview of signing and DNSSEC deployment, Joao Damas, chain of trust, and I will come to this point again. So I own a name server, what do I do now, Rasmundi, where to go for help, Roy Ahrens, and then the last item is open panel question and answers, panel discussion chaired by me. That let me point out the point number 3, the chain of trust. Mr. Director called this, I think, DNSSEC skit, but I would rather call it a spectacular theater performance that will be about DNSSEC. It has 4 acts. And just let me briefly read the cast, because that's something interesting. So starring root server Simon McCullough, .com TLE, myself, Big Bang IXE, Joao Damas, ISP, Roy Ahrens, Joe User, Mr. Director Norm Ritchie himself, Dr. Evil, Jay Daly, and narrated by Norm Ritchie. So it's a unique opportunity to see this spectacular theater performance. You can discuss it with Mr. Director, you can touch him, you can ask for signatures and everything. So please be at 4 o'clock in the upper room in Commission 2 A and B, and you will see this great thing. And that's all for now. I'm not sure if Eberhard is still following us, but I would like to thank him and the whole technical working group. Yes, I will do that. and the technical working group for preparing the agenda. I would like to thank Gabi and Christina for helping us in the whole thing, organizing, coordinating everything. Thank you for coming in such large number. That's probably the record for the working group, and see you at 4 o'clock in the upper floor. Thank you very much. Thank you.